Good afternoon and welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates. On this special edition of Your Turn, it is our periodic International Middle East Roundtable discussion. With me in the studio, I have Jerry Gordon. Jerry is my co-host today and a contributor to Your Turn on all things having to do with Israel and the Middle East. He is the senior editor at the New English Review and its blog, The Iconoclast. Welcome, Jerry.
Good to be here.
We also have Jonathan Schanzer, Washington, D.C.-based deputy executive director of the Jewish Policy Center and the editor of their Palestine Rocket Report. Jonathan Schanzer, welcome to Your Turn.
Thanks for having me.
And live from Jerusalem, we have Dan Diker, who is a Jerusalem-based foreign affairs analyst and director of the Institute for Contemporary Affairs at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks for having me on WABY.
And we have another guest in the studio, which Jerry Gordon smuggled in, and that is the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him. Sitting to my left is an image of the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him. Fortunately, he is not wearing an explosives vest. However, he does have a bomb on his head. What's the story with that, Jerry?
Well, this is one of the lithographs made out of the original Danish cartoon done by cartoonist Kurt Vestergaard. Interestingly enough, it has two autographs, one by Vestergaard himself and the other by courageous Dutch politician Geert Wilders. I earned this the hard way by setting up meetings for Vestergaard in Manhattan, as well as a presentation by Geert Vestergaard at my alma mater, Columbia University. And yes, it's in full color, not the black and white you usually see.
Yes, this is the image that created such an uproar among many Muslims throughout Europe when these cartoons were published. This is the famous one with the Prophet Muhammad with a turban.
As and shaped
the
as a bomb.
Head. Right. Right. All right. Well, hopefully that bomb, although I do see the fuse is lit, hopefully it will not explode during the next hour.
Okay.
All right, let's get to topics in the Middle East. Speaking of explosives, and this question is for you, Dan Diker, in Jerusalem. On earlier this month, the Israeli Navy stopped a shipment of rockets, missiles, mortars, grenades, anti-tank weapons that were intended for Hezbollah in Lebanon. What is the story about that?
The story about that is that this is another example of an Iranian ship flown under the guise of a Barbudian and Antiguan flags. That contained 500 tons of weaponry, including almost 3,000 short and medium range rockets, basically 10 times the amount of weaponry that was found on the very famous Karine A weapon ship of 2002. And therefore, what the Israeli intelligence agencies had actually tailed, if you will, or kept an eye on the ship as it left the port in Iran and made its way towards the port in Egypt, in which the stock was exchanged, was transshipped onto another vessel, and then its ultimate goal destination was to get up to Latakia up in the Syria, and with an intermediary stop in Beirut. Clearly, this weaponry was ultimately for the Hezbollah, sent by its father saints in Iran. And the major point from an Israeli standpoint here is how many ships have not been caught that have left the Iranian port over the last number of years headed for the same destination.
Well, and if there is an international prohibition against such arms being shipped like this, why did it fall on the Israeli Navy to stop the vessel?
That's a very good question. It's a difficult one to answer. I mean, the international community, you know, if you take as an example of the problem that you're pointing to, Mike, you take UN Security Council Resolution 1701, which was the resolution that governed the end of the Hezbollah war in 2006 against Israel. Well, you know, that internationally sanctioned agreement has been an utter failure, and Hezbollah has armed itself to the teeth, up to three times the amount of rocket arsenal that they had before. The point being that the United Nations has been a complete failure in enforcement of international law that clearly prohibits this type of international weapons trafficking. And, you know, the international community is going to have to really pull itself together and do a much better job, because ultimately it falls on the Israelis to prevent this from happening. As you know, according to foreign reports, it was the Israelis that, took out the Syrian nuclear reactor, as well as stopped other transshipments from the Sudan of the same type of weaponry up into Gaza, where the destination was Gaza. So Israel seems to be the only self-appointed policeman to try to keep the Middle East safe, and ultimately the West safe, from Iran's raids for regional hegemony and, you know, also al-Qaeda weapons that are running through the region.
John, segueing from this observation of Dan's, we noted that Prime Minister Netanyahu was aboard a submarine that is equipped with nuclear-tipped cruise missiles today, warning about the Iran nuclear threat. What's the dilemma facing Israel with regard to possibly pulling the trigger on military action?
Well, the calculus for Israel remains essentially the same. You know, I should just probably add very quickly to Dan's excellent analysis that, you know, the Israelis have not only gone after weapons destined for Hezbollah, but also for Hamas. If we recall, in March of earlier this year, Israel apparently bombed a weapons cache in Sudan, headed for the Hamas organization in the Gaza Strip. So the Israelis are constantly patrolling, you know, the states around them, trying to intercede and interdict these weapons, and ultimately, you know, sometimes has no choice but to blow them up, and they continue to sort of play cops and robbers. With regard to the nuclear program, it's not a game of cops and robbers. This is really a game of chicken. The Israelis are essentially holding their breath, hoping that the Obama administration's diplomatic offensive will somehow thwart the nuclear program. I actually had the pleasure of speaking with Ambassador Dori Gold, the former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, yesterday. And, you know, I can tell you that the attitude right now within the Netanyahu administration is that this is going to fail, and that sanctions also will almost certainly fail, primarily because the Russians and the Chinese will not work with the United States to impose multilateral sanctions. So if the United States imposes these sanctions unilaterally, they will, you know, do very little. So ultimately, you know, the Israelis still feel and fear that an attack on the Iranian nuclear program will fall on their shoulders. And the calculus largely remains the same. There can either be, you know, a number of jets scrambled to, you know, launch pinpoint attacks on the suspected sites, or, as I think the Prime Minister was indicating by boarding the submarine, that perhaps some of these attacks could be launched by remote control, which would obviously have, would cause a bit more collateral damage, but would probably ensure that the Israelis would stay out of sight and perhaps out of the reach of most of the Iranian weapons.
President Obama this morning said in China that there would be serious consequences if Iran would not demonstrate that its nuclear program was intended for, well, his term was actually peaceful and transparent purposes. We keep moving the line in the sand. There's going to be serious consequences if, and then it doesn't happen. And so then there's going to be serious consequences if, and then it doesn't happen. And then there's going to be serious consequences if, you see where I'm going with this. Are we never going to impose these serious consequences? And if we don't, if we keep moving this line in the sand, where is A, our credibility, and B, any reason for Iran to react?
Well, Mike, you've raised, you know, I think a very important question. I mean, first of all, you know, we've continued to threaten the Iranians over the course of several decades about their foreign policy and their meddling and their terrorism and you know, and their weapons programs. You know, we haven't really done anything to truly punish them, whether through sanctions or through military means. So they are really not afraid of a threat of war. I would say that, you know, 25, 30 years of threats has essentially led them to believe that the United States will not follow through on that. And now more recently, the United States has been trying to gear up the country for legislation, we love acronyms in Washington, called IRPSA, IRPSA, the Iran Refined Petroleum Sanctions Act, where we would actually stop or sanctioned companies, various European firms that have been helping Iran to refine its petroleum products so that the oil that it extracts from the ground can be used actually in ways that benefits its economy. We have threatened to impose these sanctions for months now. I mean, this legislation has been locked and loaded since the spring. We continue to push back the deadline. And the way that I was trying to describe this recently, I was at a talk in Tennessee. I was saying that this is sort of like Charlie Brown and Lucy. Every time we go to kick the football, Lucy pulls it out of the way. And this is the administration has been pulling it out of the way rather than saying, okay, we're going to do this now and we're going to actually impose sanctions and make this painful for the Iranians. We continue to pull up at the last minute and give them more leeway, and they continue to challenge the United States and the rest of the world because they do not fear the sanctions.
Well, and as you pointed out a moment ago, unilateral sanctions would probably not be very effective. What is the likelihood of getting Russian and Chinese cooperation to impose true international sanctions that can be effective?
Well, I don't think it's very good, but I do think that it would be extremely important for the United States to impose these sanctions first. In other words, to be the leader of the free world, to be the country that takes the lead in trying to punish Iran. Once we do that, we can say, listen, we've done this, we're asking for your assistance. But by not doing it, I think we are just failing to back up our words. And that, I think, is probably the biggest problem we face right now.
I think you have a bigger problem. I think, Jonathan, the president's language has actually gone south in terms of its severity. The president's saying today that Iran must prove the international community of its peaceful intentions for its nuclear program. I mean, what you have here is a real slide back in terms of the more threatening posture of language that was used in the former Bush administration, in which declared that it was clear to the international community and the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iran does have a military nuclear program and does intend to produce a nuclear weapon. And so now what we've done here is we've really slid backwards with the Americans taking the lead under the leadership of Mr. Obama, sliding backwards to say, not only are we saying to the Iranians, we know that you're building nuclear military capabilities and threatening to extinguish the state of Israel from the map every day, but you should prove to us that your intentions for nuclear proliferation are peaceful. I think the line in the sand has been drawn way behind where the language had been a year ago.
And if it was truly a peaceful program, there would be no need to, A, develop it in secret, and B, bury it hundreds of feet down in hardened bunkers. Of course it's not a peaceful nuclear program.
Absolutely. And I'll add just one more thing to Dan's analysis, and that is, the administration has, not only, I think, dropped back in terms of the rhetoric, but even the plan that was floating around last month where Iran would be asked to ship part of its stockpile of low-enriched uranium abroad, even that, I think, has been stepping back from where the U.S. position should be. In other words, what that would indicate is that it's okay for Iran to enrich uranium as long as it ships it abroad, but essentially that would give the Iranians the ability to continue to, maintain the core of its nuclear program. So I would say that in this sort of game of chicken that the United States is playing with Iran, we've lost consistently. We've blinked first, and I would say that we've, we may have a president that, was given the Nobel Prize for Peace, but I would say that his inability to challenge a bully country like Iran will ultimately undermine peace in the region because no one will be there to actually enforce the rule of law.
Actually, I think Ahmadinejad is laughing all the way to the bank because he has the Arak, ARAK, reactor, which produces plutonium, and he has more than ample stuff to produce nukes out of that alone. I'd like to turn to an issue that arose yesterday, kind of strategically. As you both know, Prime Minister Netanyahu gave a speech at the Saban Center in Jerusalem. And the question is, what did he reveal there that he also discussed in his cabinet meetings? Dan?
With regard to what are you referring to specifically?
Well, he had a number of issues that he raised in the Saban Center speech. The question is, I think, for our listener audience, why don't you give us the benefit of what he said and why he said it?
Well, the most important message coming out of the Netanyahu administration in the past days has been the threat made by the Palestinian Authority of driving their desire and their intention to declare a unilateral state on the June 4th, 1967 line into the Security Council to try to draft Security Council support for that intention. There's been a flurry of statements made by the Palestinian Authority. It's been all over the news in the Middle East. I believe it's been all over the news in the West as well, all the way from PA Chairman Mahmoud Abbas who says we already have a Palestinian state, we just need to get formal recognition of the 67 lines, which of course are indefensible lines for Israel and not lines that in any way can be dictated unilaterally by the Palestinians. The message of Netanyahu was and continues to be that Israel is committed to a negotiated solution which is enshrined in international law, beginning with UN Security Council Resolution 242 of November 1967, which has governed every single diplomatic initiative between the Arabs and the Israelis, and continues to do so. And the Oslo Accords, especially the interim accord of 1995, still governs the formal diplomatic relationship between Israel and its Palestinian neighbors. So the notion is really the threat that has been advanced by the Palestinian leadership in the past days, really beginning more subtly in August, late August 2009, with the issuance, the publication of the Fayyad unilateral plan to statehood, Fayyad, of course, being the unelected prime minister of the Palestinian Authority. That has created a whirlwind in Israel of concern. And Netanyahu said yesterday at the Saban Forum, there is no replacement for a negotiated solution between the sides. Mahmoud Abbas has been hiding under the couch, refusing to negotiate with Israel, because Israel has, in Netanyahu's sense, restored a symmetry of claims demanding recognition of a Jewish state in opposite to the demands for a Palestinian state, and demanding defensible borders, demilitarization of a future Palestinian state. The Palestinian leadership rejects each one of those Israeli conditions, and therefore they've moved towards unilateralism as a strategy. And Netanyahu's message at the Saban Center is, that is unacceptable to Israel. Israel is committed to bilateral negotiations, but if the Palestinians insist in unraveling the only legal document that still governs the relationship between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, well, the Israelis will take their own measures and not be committed after any kind of unilateral declaration to maintaining a negotiated solution, which means that Israel would be under Israel's own right to start annexing territory in the disputed Judea and Samaria of the West Bank as well.
I'd like to address this some more. We do need to take a break right now. We'll be right back with more of this international roundtable discussion here on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Good afternoon and welcome back to your turn. This is Mike Bates, the host, along with Jerry Gordon, my co-host today, with our international Middle East roundtable discussion. We have with us on the line from Washington, D.C., Jonathan Schanzer. He is the D.C.-based Deputy Executive Director of the Jewish Policy Center, editor of the Palestine Rocket Report. And from Jerusalem, we have Dan Diker. He's the Jerusalem-based Foreign Affairs Analyst and Director of the Institute for Contemporary Affairs at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Jerry, we were talking about this unilateral declaration of a Palestinian state that they want to bypass the bilateral negotiations with Israel and deal directly with the United Nations and just simply be declared, wave of the wand, okay, now you're a sovereign state. Israel obviously wants nothing to do with that. They want to pursue this through bilateral talks. if it was any other time, I would say that the United States would veto such a measure even if it got that far. But I'm not so sure about that at this time. What do you think?
Well, I think that's correct. We saw Senator Lieberman at the same Saban Forum in Jerusalem pretty much say that as a major figure, an independent thinker, essentially, in the U.S. Senate. And that today we had an interesting development. We had Sweden's Foreign Minister Carl Bildt, who said that the conditions aren't there yet for the Palestinians to even consider doing that. And for the EU to say that, that is kind of significant. John, you've written about this. What can you tell us?
Well, you know, I think that apart from the fact that people realize that this would sort of kill Arab-Israeli diplomacy, this would really be a bad move for the Palestinians. I mean, essentially all of their claims on Jerusalem or their claims for refugees would be out the window, primarily because, you know, the Israelis have agreed to work with them on this in the context of negotiations. That would be out the door. There's also a question of how the two territories, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, would be connected if the Israelis were essentially to view the Palestinians as a hostile entity after this unilateral declaration. There's no way that the Israelis would connect the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. There's also a question, which I've addressed in the past on the show, of leadership. You know, the fact that there are two different territories under the control of two different factions, Hamas and Fatah. You know, this is the absolute wrong time for the Palestinians to even think about this. But I would tell you, what I would actually argue is that the only reason why they are doing this is because they're taking the cues from President Obama, who has indicated that unilateral demands on the Israelis and unilateral declarations are somehow okay. In other words, pushing the Israelis to do certain things such as cease settlement activity. This is something that they're taking the lead from our president on. And I actually attribute all of these unilateral moves and threats to the White House policy dating back over the last 6 to 8 months.
All right, Jonathan, thank you. We have got to take a break now for CNN News. We will be back with more of our international Middle East roundtable discussion with Jerry Gordon, Jonathan Schanzer, and Dan Diker from, Pensacola, Washington, and Jerusalem. When your turn continues here on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's talk radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates in Pensacola, WEBY. We are in the middle of our international Middle East roundtable discussion. Jerry Gordon is with me in the studio. He is the senior editor at the New English Review and its blog, The Iconoclast. And Jonathan Schanzer joins us from Washington, D.C. He's the D.C.-based deputy executive director of the Jewish Policy Center and the editor of their Palestine Rocket Report. And from Jerusalem, Dan Diker, who is a Jerusalem-based foreign affairs analyst and director of the Institute for Contemporary Affairs at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Question for you, Dan, on the motivation. What is the motivation, in your eyes, behind this desire for a unilateral declaration of a Palestinian state? Why do they want to abandon direct talks with Israel?
Well, when you look behind the black veil, as it were, of the Palestinian Authority, you come to understand that a strategic decision, in my assessment, has been made by the Palestinian Authority leadership to jettison bilateral negotiations and adopt unilateral direction. And that is in large part due to three factors. Number one, there is a lot of tension, clearly, between Fatah and the Hamas. The Hamas has threatened Mahmoud Abbas. The Hamas has insulted Mahmoud Abbas. And the split between Hamas-ruled Gaza and Fatah-ruled Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, it seems for the coming time, and it could be the coming years, to be permanent. Number two, there's a lot of tension between Abbas himself and the U.S. administration. Because the Palestinians have really felt, from their point of view, betrayed by President Obama because of the administration's about face on their former precondition that Israel freeze all settlements, including in Jerusalem and including settlements in natural growth settlements that had been agreed upon completely by the Bush administration. So from the Palestinian point of view, they can't necessarily depend on Obama's enforcement of preconditions, which the first of which he's already gone back on. And then they look over at Israel, and they have a prime minister, Mr. Netanyahu, who for the first time in a number of years has restored some of Israel's basic vital requirements for peacemaking, whether it's the recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, whether it's the security conditions we talked about earlier, and therefore and a united Jerusalem that Mr. Netanyahu has sworn to maintain as the eternal capital, 3,200-year capital of the Jewish people. So from Abbas's point of view, he sees these data points, and he said, my gosh, I don't have much of a choice except to go this alone and go unilaterally. And he says, my best ally is the international community. And if you look at the recently republished Goldstone report, which is the UN Human Rights Council, vicious attack on the state of Israel over its defensive war in Gaza, the Palestinian calculation is that the delegitimization of Israel, which they led, actually, because it was the Palestinian Authority that triggered the investigation of the Human Rights Council against Israel, and they figure that they can shop around the delegitimization of Israel among many in the international community and lever up their own legitimacy for a unilaterally declared state at the same time that they smash Israel over the head with a delegitimization that it would be very comfortable for many in the international community to accept. So that in a way gives you a little bit of some of the Palestinian-driven motivation for driving this unilateral declaration. And I'm not sure that the game is over, even though Swedish Foreign Minister Bildt today said that the time wasn't right. He didn't say in principle he disagreed with it. What he said was the time wasn't right, which means the Palestinians have in the meantime delayed elections. And before there are Palestinian elections, the Europeans can't possibly support a Palestinian play for unilateral statehood until that there's a proper government, because it'll make the Europeans look silly to support this type of a Palestinian move when there's no legitimate democratically elected government on the Palestinian side.
Dan, doesn't this reflect something that the world has become aware of, at least in diplomatic circles, that particularly in the Arab world, that they're beginning not to trust Obama and his team?
Well, we certainly do see that, Jerry, among some of the larger Sunni countries. That started back in the second Bush term under Secretary Rice, when a lot of the countries, whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's Egypt, the Gulf states, became very concerned when Secretary of State Rice, who then handed off the notion that the Palestinian issue had to be resolved in order to contain Iran, that sort of misassessment created a lot of concern in Arab capitals. And of course, Secretary Rice's summary to the Obama administration that the Palestinian-Israeli issue was nearly resolved sort of drove the enthusiasm of the Obama administration to continue that misassessment, and the Arab reaction to that has become more severe, to the point at which I think there's a lot of secret cooperation between Israel and some of its neighbors with respect to a recognition that the major problem in the Middle East for everyone is an emerging ascendant nuclear Iran.
John, I want to segue to a strange partnership that has emerged in Washington, D.C. in the wake of the creation of this alleged pro-peace, pro-Israel group called J Street. And it concerns essentially revelations that have come up in the press, particularly the writings of Eli Lake in the Washington Times. I wonder what you can tell us about that.
Sure. Well, Eli broke a tremendous story whereby he shed some light on the fact that the Iranians had a number of organizations operating here in the United States that were essentially funneling funds directly to Iran from the United States, which is obviously illegal. It's been illegal since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. And among the organizations listed as working directly with the Iranians and violating U.S. law was NIAC, the National Iranian American Council. And in the process, essentially, of looking through documents that became public through a lawsuit, it became clear that NIAC was actually working with a group that we've talked about here on this show in the past, and that's J Street, what they call themselves the pro-peace, pro-Israel lobby here in Washington, but they have consistently adopted what I would call anti-Israel policies or anti-Israel lines. So they've been the source of a great deal of controversy in recent months. And now we understand that they've been working with some of these Iranian organizations. And notably, there's some really interesting things that came out of this investigation. But one of the more interesting ones to my mind was the fact that NIAC and J Street were trying to scuttle the appointment of Ambassador Dennis Ross as the envoy to Iran in the early goings of the Obama administration. This is a guy who most people would tout as a moderate, but they saw him as a threat to Iranian interests. But the fact that these two organizations would somehow team up, you know, in any way, I think really undercuts the notion that J Street is a pro-Israel lobby in the first place. So there's a lot of egg in the face of J Street right now as this story continues to unfold.
Who is the interlocutor financing these groups like J Street and NIAC at this point?
Well, we know that George Soros was behind at least the founding of J Street, and now we know that there are a number of Iranian and Arab donors to J Street, which has further undercut its position as a sort of a pro-Israel lobby. So, you know, the more that comes out on these organizations, the more the American public and particularly the Jewish community here in the United States realizes that this is an organization that can't be trusted.
Doesn't this make the White House's attempt at isolating Israel via J Street look foolish?
Well, it definitely makes the administration look bad for even having contacts with J Street at this point. Let alone listening to their, to their policy recommendations. You know, it's becoming clear, at least to my mind, that this is an organization that has disgraced itself. It was disgraced in its very founding, but now as we learn more and more about it, it's not an organization that should be helping anyone make policy inside the Beltway. So, you know, the hope is that the administration pulls back from from its dealings with this organization, which is to a certain extent stepped in to some of the roles that AIPAC had played in previous administrations.
All right, we are having our Middle East roundtable discussion with Jonathan Schanzer from Washington, D.C., and with Dan Diker from Jerusalem, and Jerry Gordon here in Pensacola, Florida. We're going to take our final break of the hour, and then we will come back with more on Your Turn here on 1330 WEBY.
Now, back to Your Turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's talk radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Bates, and with me in the studio, Jerry Gordon. He is my co-host today, and he is a senior editor at the New English Review and its blog, The Iconoclast. Jonathan Schanzer joins us from Washington, D.C. He's the executive director of the Jewish Policy Center and the editor of their Palestine Rocket Report. From Jerusalem, Dan Diker joins us. He is the Jerusalem-based foreign affairs analyst and director of the Institute for Contemporary Affairs at Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs. Jerry, I'm going to throw this back to you because you had a follow-up question for Dan regarding J Street.
Yes, I did. Dan, J Street is also an Israeli story, isn't it? And what can you tell us about the reactions?
It is an Israeli story, very much so, because the pretense of J Street is to be a pro-Israel, pro-peace organization, meaning that it represents the best interests of Israel, when in fact it has very little to do with Israel and very much to do with J Street. J Street is pro-J Street and anti-Israel. Now, why is it anti-Israel? Because J Street's positions completely contradict the minimal security requirements that the government of Israel has set out for itself, opposite these, Iranian-sponsored threats that Israel has to its north, to its south, and even in Judea, Samaria, the West Bank. For the J Street crowd to essentially claim for itself the necessity to make policy on behalf of the state of Israel and then say that they represent the best interest, they're pro-Israel, they represent the interest of the state of Israel, is just patently absurd. And this is a disingenuous organization that is staffed by that people, some of them well-meaning, like Jeremy Ben-Ami, whom I happened to go to school with for 12 years in New York City before university. He's a very bright and well-meaning fellow, but he is completely off base and some of the other people involved with the organization are further off base. It has nothing to do with Israel's best interest. So if they were to come clean and be honest and say that J Street represents itself and its own notion of perhaps being disenchanted and distant from the state of Israel, then it really, to be very frank with you, is more of a therapy group in the United States that uses the Israeli issue in order to garner support, because you know Israel obviously is a popular brand name in the United States among many in the Jewish community, and they're using it completely for their own purpose.
I can also just add very quick to Dan's analysis that, if you look at the interactions between the Israeli government, the embassy here in Washington and J Street, relations are very cold. J Street had initially asked Ambassador Michael Oren to attend its recent policy conference. Oren ultimately declined and instead sent an observer rather than having someone participate in their conference. And essentially, Oren does not meet or cooperate with J Street. I would actually probably argue in very, sort of layman's terms, he has them in timeout. And I don't expect him to engage with J Street at any time in the near future.
Dan, one observation about huddling in Israel of both U.S. and Israeli intelligence amid a report that a Revolutionary Guard General Askari, who brought out some of the information about Iran's nuclear program, is in Israel and perhaps singing like a canary. What do you think this does to the folks in Tehran?
Well, without regard to whether the story is accurate or how accurate or details and so on, what it does to Iran clearly is to blow a hole in what they like to assume or create a pretense to having the sort of bulletproof self-confidence that Ahmadinejad has used in staring down President Obama and the West. And I think what they see here is little Israel chipping away at their best human assets. And I think that it creates an important message. It sends an important message to the Iranian regime from the state of Israel that Israel's long arm, as it has been called traditionally, can extend even into the depths of Iran. And therefore, Iran would do well, taking this as a signal, to be careful and stop threatening to incinerate the state of Israel with nuclear weapons. Because the state of Israel has said, from the political left to the right, to the military echelon, the intelligence echelon, that Israel knows how to defend itself. And I think that, the reports that you're talking about General Asghari being closer geographically to Israel than he is to Tehran, is a good signal of Israel's abilities. And I think that the Iranians are probably, behind closed doors, are getting that message.
Question for you, Jonathan Schanzer. On November 5th, we had a shooting in Fort Hood, and it was Major Nidal Malik Hassan who allegedly shouted Allahu Akbar while killing 13 of his fellow soldiers and wounding 30 others. And I've heard very disturbing comments from the Secretary of the Army that he doesn't want to see diversity become a casualty of this. Have we lost our focus, and are we sacrificing our own security and the lives of our own troops in exchange for can't we all just get along nonsense?
I can tell you that I am utterly confused by the position of our Secretary of Defense. I'm also confused by the position of our President. There are a couple of, I think, excellent comments made here inside the Beltway. One was, in the words of Larry Haas, actually a former speechwriter to Al Gore, said that the rush to non-judgment was an incredible thing to watch. In other words, no one wanted to, openly state that this was a jihadist that had carried out essentially a terrorist attack on a U.S. base against U.S. personnel. And, only over, the course of several weeks has the press come around to admit this, and has the U.S. government essentially come around to admitting this. The other thing, and this was mentioned by Cliff May of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, and I think this is actually also very appropriate, He said, can you imagine in the 1940s if somebody had walked onto a U.S. military base and started yelling Heil Hitler before shooting soldiers? There would be no question where this person stood and what the goals of that person would have been. You know, the fact that this guy was yelling Allahu Akbar, this is a jihadist call to arms. And it was very, very clear that he had jihadist motivations. Whether this was planned with, you know, with other terrorist, you know, elements, we don't know. But we know that he had some dealings with some radical imams and, or preachers in the past. And, you know, we know that this guy had motivations that can only be ascribed right now to, you know, to jihad. So the fact that we've been very slow to come around to this, I think, indicates that the country has largely gone back to sleep after 9/11. In other words, we woke up to the threat on September 11th or maybe September 12th as we began to discuss the problems of radical Islam or jihadism. And now we are sort of shying away from that. We're sort of hoping that maybe things will go back to the way they were. I think a lot of Americans are hoping that we don't have to fight this long war and that we're getting tired of all these various fronts. But I think that the attacks by Major Hassan was, you know, a strong indication that this war is far from over and that there will be continued threats to the United States, both at home and abroad.
Well, and if he really did shout Allahu Akbar while shooting, and all accounts are that he did, then he clearly did not murder his fellow soldiers because he was upset that there were cold potatoes in the mess hall. This clearly was a jihadist act of terrorism.
Absolutely. And I would say that everything that we're seeing at this point now indicates that. But, you know, again, the fact that we were so slow to come around to this, you know, whether this was something that was pre-planned or what my former boss Daniel Pipes calls sudden jihad syndrome, it doesn't really matter. The point is we know what the motivations were of this individual, and we are, for whatever reason, afraid to look at this in this country.
Well,
and I think that this, you know, underscores, again, you know, the question of whether the U.S. has lost its will.
Well, I fear that we have, which segues into the decision by Attorney General Eric Holder to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other conspirators in New York City for the September 11th, 2001 attacks, as opposed to trying them in a military tribunal. What do you think, one, of the motivation behind that, and two, do you think this is a mistake?
Well, it's absolutely a mistake. This is part of the Obama administration's campaign to sort of shed sunlight on our entire system of prosecuting terrorists involved with Al-Qaeda, you know, from closing down Gitmo to holding, you know, holding trials in New York City. You know, this is all part of a larger plan to get the world to believe that we're, you know, on the side of good, when I don't think there really is a need to prove to the world that, we are. At all. I think what this is going to do, you know, my sense is that, A, it's going to cause a lot of pain to the families of the 9/11 victims. You know, they're based in New York, and they're going to be watching this guy walk in, you know, every day for possibly a year or more, trying to get out of, you know, his responsibilities. You know, this is a man that is clearly guilty of planning the 9/11 attacks. And the fact that he will even have an opportunity to get off the hook after admitting that he was the planner is going to cause a lot of pain and anguish to, you know, to those families of the 9/11 victims. You know, not to mention that, you know, it's going to be a security threat. The fact that this man is going to be based in New York will definitely, I think, raise the eyebrows of some, you know, jihadist types that will think about trying to carry out attacks to send messages to the United States and to try to defend.
Yeah, Jonathan, I'm going to have to cut you off there because the clock is ticking and I've got very little time left. So I appreciate you coming on the program. Jonathan Schanzer from Washington, D.C., Dan Diker from Jerusalem, and Jerry Gordon here in Pensacola. Appreciate all of you joining us today for this International Middle East Roundtable discussion here on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio.